Welcome to ArcLight Stories. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ArcLight, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
Our theme for today's episode is Out with the Old, Stories About Change. All of these stories are true, and they were recorded live in front of an audience at one of our ArcLight events.
You know, I took some creative writing classes in college, and since then I've read, you know, a bunch of screenwriting books and storytelling books, and I agree 100% with the fact that any story that's really worth telling is a story about some kind of change. I would even argue that if you've got a story that doesn't have any change in it, then you don't really have a story at all. You've got more of like a, I don't know, a montage of events or a comedy routine. I don't know. But it's the change that makes it so powerful. It's the change that makes it worth telling.
Yeah, and the change we're talking about today is a very specific kind. We're bringing you three stories all about a change in perception, how we perceive the world around us, how we perceive different people in our lives, and even how we perceive ourselves. In fact, that's exactly what this first story is all about. It was recorded live at an event we hosted back in September at Urban Standard here in Birmingham. The theme for the night was Spark, Stories About Inspiration. So here is storyteller Sean Bess.
Growing up, I wanted to be an entertainer. And in elementary school, I wanted to be a comedian. In middle school, I wanted to be an actor. High school rolled around, I thought I wanted something a little edgier for my life, as high schoolers are known to want. So, of course, I decided to be a musician. And then my band played at our high school talent show. And a girl held up a sign that said, Mr. Best, tear it up in my pants, which turned out to be far too edgy for my taste. So I redirected and went back to the former ambition of being an actor, and decided to audition at a talent agency. We were told to have a monologue ready for the audition, and I chose Matt Damon's monologue from Saving Private Ryan. In the movie, Damon's character, he loses all of his brothers in World War II, and towards the end of the film, he recounts his most recent memory of his brothers, the last time all of them were together. The monologue involves this detailed description of a makeout scene, right, in which one of the brothers struggles to remove his girlfriend's bra. And it's actually a really poignant moment in the film. But what I didn't realize was that the audition, it wasn't one-on-one. It was a group audition. So I showed up. They brought all of us together into one room, guys and girls, adults and children. And there was this massive runway in the center of the room. And they told us, when your name is called, you make your way up to the runway. If you're a model, you're going to walk to the end. You're going to strike a pose. You're going to walk back, you're going to strike a pose, you're going to sit down. If you're auditioning as an actor, you're going to walk to the end, you're going to perform your monologue, you're going to sit back down. So I'm nervous. I'm sitting in my seat. I'm looking around the room, kind of waiting for my name to be called. I'm looking at all these like fresh, apple-cheeked children. And it occurs to me, you know, this monologue from an R-rated war film is not going to go over very well. This just isn't the right audience. But there was nothing I could do about it at this point, short of getting up and leaving the room. So my name was called, and kind of stumbled to the end of the runway and started performing the monologue. And things were going fine, great even, right up until I got to the portion of the monologue dealing with the makeout scene, specifically the bit where the brother is wrestling with his girlfriend's bra. At which point, the owner of the talent agency, who happens to be sitting directly in front of me, she lifts her clipboard and covers her face and begins whispering to one of the talent agents seated next to her. Now, she could have been saying something like, this kid's going to be a star. But I wasn't delusional enough to believe that. Even still, I pressed on. I continued to kind of power through the monologue right up until she lifted her clipboard up into the air. Okay, she said, that's enough. And then with that, she handed me a scratch sheet of paper with a Twizzlers advertisement written on it. I had spent hours going over this monologue, preparing, and she hands me three lines from a Twizzlers ad. So I read it, and I was deflated. I just felt utterly defeated. And then I kind of, like, slouched back to my seat, And I sat there once again, looking around the room at all of these now blushing prepubescents and sitting next to their parents who were kind of like clutching at their pearls in horror. The girl sitting next to me leaned over and she whispered, "That was awkward." and it was awkward. To my everlasting surprise, though, they decided to represent me. Several months later, I got a call from my contact at the agency. Her name's Misty. Misty called me and she said, "We've got a job for you, and it's for a CD. It's a photo shoot. I know you didn't you auditioned as an actor, but you know it pays well." All she would tell me though is that I was going to be a groom in this photo shoot. I explained to Misty that I had just been hired on at Olive Garden. And that I might be busy, you know, carting around all-you-can-eat salad and breadsticks. And she said, "Well, you know what? I think this is a great opportunity. I really want you to do it. But if you can't, I understand." A few days later, I was able to get my shifts covered. And I made the drive to Nashville, Tennessee. And I arrived at the studio. And this hulking, surly-faced, intimidating guy rolled down the tinted window of his big black SUV, and he said, "Can I help you?" And all I knew to say in that moment was, I'm the groom. And that's all Misty had told me. And so the dude was wearing sunglasses, and I remember feeling like I was in a staring contest with the Terminator or something. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger, circa 1987, he dropped out of his SUV, and he told me to wait right there. And he went inside. He came back out a couple minutes later and said, "You know, go on in." So I'm walking around the studio for what felt like half an hour, meeting wardrobe and makeup people, shaking hands with assistants. I'm speaking with the photographer. And then this really sweet lady, the photographer's wife, she walked up and she's talking with me. And then she asks, "Do you know what you're doing here?" I'm the groom. And she leans in, she smiles, and she says almost in a whisper, "This is for Taylor Swift's new album." And I must confess, I knew next to nothing about Taylor Swift or her music, but even still, I understood that she was a very big deal. And so my heart kind of just fell out of rhythm for a moment, like a four-year-old kid on a kick drum, and my mouth went dry, kind of like it is right now. And I was struggling to swallow, and spit was collecting in the back of my throat. I thought I was going to choke to death and die. So I excused myself. I went to the restroom to try and regain some semblance of self-assurance. You see, I knew that I was in way over my head. I did not belong there, but I couldn't let them figure that out. So I splashed my face with some cold water. I took a couple deep breaths, and I exited the bathroom. And a minute or two later, Taylor Swift comes out, and she, like, smiles that all-American Nashville smile, and she introduces herself. She shakes my hand. "Hey, I'm Taylor. Hey, I'm the groom." We all left and headed for this 19th century antebellum mansion sitting at the end of this long tree-lined gravel driveway. Waiting for me there was this suit perfectly fitted to my measurements. I threw it on and we started the photo shoot off to the side of the mansion at this small gazebo that they had like ornamented with white lilacs. It looked really nice. The photographer had Taylor standing inside with an arm wrapped around one of these beams, looking as important as royalty. He had me standing at the bottom of the steps with my suit jacket thrown over my shoulder, looking like the help. And I held her hand, and I leaned in for a kiss, and never making contact. And I just remember light was like reflecting off of this Valentino dress that probably costed more than I make in a year or two. And I leaned in towards it, towards the glow, as if I was being like summoned by a UFO tractor beam. And then the photographer started giving us all these cues. "You're flirting," he said. "You're having a good time. Smile, laugh." So we smiled and we laughed, kind of following his direction. And then Taylor, I think in an effort to make our interaction more believable, more natural, she started up some small talk. "So," she said, "would you rather live in a lighthouse or on a houseboat?" "On a houseboat," I answered immediately. And I had a reason. I said, "Because I'd like to be able to travel places." But then I started second-guessing myself. I'm like, wait, are all houseboats actually travel-ready? You know, or do some of them just kind of like float in place? And I shook it off. I was like, you know, questions we'll ask God. Who knows? And then I thought, you know, it's my turn to ask. So what about you? And she said, a lighthouse. And that was that. So it got quiet for a minute, which I took to mean it was my turn to ask a question. And I kind of thought for a minute. And then I asked, so do you like music? And in my defense, I was trying to be ironic. I was trying to be clever. And then Taylor Swift looked down at me in her Valentino dress with those like perfectly symmetrical facial features that God only gives famous people. Probably because he knows that their faces are going to end up on magazine covers and big screens and all that good stuff. She's looking down at me and she says, what? And I look at, I'm like staring at my feet at that point. Never mind, nothing, I say. Realizing immediately that I will forever remember that as the moment in time I tried and failed to make Taylor Swift laugh. And I was humiliated. We finished up some more shots at this gazebo. We made our way to the entrance of the property. And the photographer had us run up and down this driveway hand in hand. And it was blistering hot. But in that moment, I'm thinking to myself, am I supposed to try and look sexy? Or am I supposed to smile like it's Christmas morning? You know, what is my motivation? Like, what am I feeling? But then I realized I don't know how to project like the sexy vibe. So I smiled as if I was like opening a present or something. And then we finished the photos and I found one of the assistants and I asked her how it looked. And she said, well, you looked happy. I was like, nailed it. When Taylor Swift's CD was finally released, my mom called me to tell me she had bought several copies, which I took to mean a case. And I had just woken up. I was still half asleep. And she said, Sean, they didn't use your photos. And I could hear the sadness in her voice. Now, in truth, I was disappointed. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't. But I wasn't in the same universe of sadness as her. I was disappointed, though. And I have a hunch that it had something to do with my bad joke that fell flat. But I was okay. Several months later, I got another call from Misty saying I'd been hired for another job. This time, for a Taylor Swift music video. And at this point, I'm kind of feeling like one of her seasonal employees or something. I keep getting these calls. Now, I still like had that aftertaste of rejection and disappointment. I was a little gun-shy, but I took the work. The pay was good, once again, so I took the work. And I drove 3.5 hours, it was, to the location of the video shoot. Now, when I arrived, I was escorted to this holding room filled with, like, all of these actors/models. And in one corner, there was, like, hair and makeup. In the other corner, there was, like, a snack table or something at the far end set all of the talent. So I, like, kind of found a seat. It felt like the first day of school. I found a seat across from this guy who would not stop, like, smoldering. And, like, and he kept telling me about his acting/modeling work in New York. And then panic kind of began to set in. It was like bubbling up inside of me, like something carbonated or like bad heartburn or something. And then out of the corner of my eye, I see this group break out into dance in front of like the snack table, just randomly. They start like dancing. And then at the other end of the room, another group, they're just changing clothes in plain sight. They're getting naked. And then the panic is growing because, first of all, I've never been a great dancer. So I wasn't about to join in on that madness. And then there was no way I was going to take off my shirt with all of, like, these six-packs watching me. All of them, if it's any indication, they were all just, like, shredded, like Brad Pitt in Fight Club. Like, they were just, like, if you've seen the movie, you know. Like, Google Brad Pitt, and, like, Google will automatically fill in, like, Fight Club workout or something. Like, everyone wants to know how to get shredded like Brad Pitt. They all were. So the panic was growing. And then, at this point, I noticed the stylist running her fingers through the hair of one of the actors/models. And it hits me that I had not washed my hair in a couple of days. don't ask me why. And the panic attack was in full swing. I mean, there was no way I was going to let this professional stylist run her fingers through my dirty, unkept, feral locks. It just wasn't going to happen. So the panic was just, it was taking me over. It was possessing me. And before I knew what was happening, it had me on my feet, standing in front of someone in charge, speaking the words, "I have to leave." And she had a headset on. She had a clipboard. She had a walkie-talkie. And she was just staring blankly back at me. And I apologized, and I headed for the exit. I got in my car, and I went through a fast food drive-thru. I bought a chocolate-dipped ice cream cone, and I began the long drive back home. In that moment, something, it's not going to seem sensational, but for me, it was kind of incredible. Something kind of incredible happened. I sank my teeth into that cold, brittle chocolate shell, and then that sweetness of the soft serve, it hit my taste buds. And a smile just stretched across my face. I was happy. Looking back, I realized it wasn't simply panic that drove me away from that video shoot. That was more of like a symptom. What drove me away from that moment, and I haven't returned to that since, what drove me away from that moment was this realization that what I wanted to be wasn't what I wanted to be after all. Growing up, it was my dream to be an entertainer. It's what I thought I wanted. But that chocolate-dipped ice cream cone, that thing did more for me in about the 30 seconds of its short life than my very brief stint in the entertainment world ever did. It made me happy. So Taylor Swift gave me two opportunities to fulfill a childhood dream and potentially begin a life as an entertainer. But in actuality, she was my unwitting inspiration to finally let go of that dream and to pursue another one. Thank you.
Sean Bess is a freelance writer here in Birmingham. He blogs at seanbess.tumblr.com, and you can find him on Twitter at Sean Bess.
You know, the opportunities that Sean gets in the story, they're not enormous life-altering opportunities. But at the same time, I mean, they're pretty big deals. But I admire the courage that it took to just say, I decide that I don't want this anymore and walk away.
Yeah, I mean, I think it illustrates that so many of us are reluctant for change because it goes against everything we think we've always wanted, when sometimes that change is exactly what we need.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, coming up, when you work with children, you inevitably have to deal with both the good kids and the bad kids. But what do you do when you have to deal with the worst kid? We'll find out. This is ArcLight Stories, Birmingham's own true stories. This is ArcLight Stories. We're bringing you true personal stories recorded live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm Taylor Robinson, director of ArcLight. And today we've got stories that are all about change. You know, we've all heard the phrase, you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover. And one of the hardest things to change about ourselves is the way we perceive other people who we've already passed that judgment on. And that is exactly what this next story is about. It was recorded live at our most recent event at the Avon Theater. And that event's theme was also Out with the Old, Stories About Change. Here is Jonathan Owen.
Thank you. Like you said, I work at a campus ministry of our church, and this is going on our 19th summer that I've been working. We have about 350 kids a week for 9 weeks at our camp, and early on, I started working in ninth grade, you know, just as volunteer. Early on, I came to the realization that there are really three kinds of kids. There are good kids. Like, these are the kids that you absolutely adore. You're like, they're your favorite. You're not allowed to say it, but they are, you know? Like, you let them wear your hat, they're right on your back. It's like, I would work with these kids for free. Second kind of kid are the bad kids. These are the people that make your life miserable. These are the people that it's Friday night in the summer, and I'm going to bed at 8 o'clock, and I'm happy about it. Like, these are the kids, they can't pay you enough to work with. You put the good kids and the bad kids together, you kind of got a nice medium salary, you know? Then there's the third kind of kid that I refer to as the weird kid. You remember, you know what I'm talking about? They're not good, they're not bad, they're just like What? You know, do you remember the, maybe, I'm sure some of you showed up tonight and you were that weird kid. Maybe you still are. Give me an example. One time I was in my office, and our campus at our church, so I'm in my office, and this kid runs in my office. He's like, John, you got to come here. And I was like, what's wrong? He's like, there's a two in the one. And I was like, there's a what in the what? And like, he leads me out of the office, and we run down, and he leads me into the bathroom, which is never good. Hold on, don't get ahead of me. And so I go into the bathroom, and there's four boys on the ground rolling in laughter. And I look, and a kid has pooped in the urinal. All the kids were calling it a slam dunk, which I thought was pretty creative. I was like, Mom, yeah, that's pretty good. I just wish I had walked in on it, you know? Anyway, not really, but you know what I'm saying. I just like to see how that works. I don't know. Another time, a counselor brought his kid to me, and he'd been getting in a fight at lunch. And I knew the kid kind of well, and he's the third kind, the weird kind. Brought him in my office, and he sits down, and I was like, buddy, what's going on? He's like, man, I'm tired of this. I'm sick and tired of the way I'm getting treated at this camp. I was like, well, buddy, I am so sorry. What's going on? He's like, man, everyone's calling me donkey. I was like, that's not the worst. I mean, that's, you know. I was like, really? He's like, man, I'm tired. Like, you call me donkey. I'm tired. And I knew this kid well enough to follow that up with this question. I said, are you doing anything that might lead kids to call you donkey? And he said, well, a lot of times I'll run up behind kids and go, donkey! I was like, don't do that. Like, that's really easy. Don't do that. It'll be great. One other time, it was a really similar situation. You see this kid walking down with his counselor. The kid's eyes are red. The counselor looks a little frustrated. And the kid's got a towel wrapped around his waist really tightly. And it's like, oh, this is going to be fun. And so he walks up to me. And he's like, man, this kid's getting in fights. Can you talk to him? And I kind of get down. You know, the kid's about maybe 9, 10 years old. I was like, buddy, what's going on? And he just starts crying. He's like, man, everyone says I have girl pants on. I was like, and I look at the other director with me, and I was like, you have what? He's like, everyone says I have girl pants on. I don't. And I said, well, why don't you show me your pants, and I'll let you know if you have girl pants on or not. I mean, what else am I going to do? So he kind of looks around, and he's holding his towel, because, you know, apparently he's got girl pants on. And so, and now I'm like, what are girls? Like, you know, like, I'm going to just find out what these things are. And so he kind of like looks around, and it's just, you know, we're kind of not near any kids. And he kind of just flashes a towel real quick. And then he has jean cutoffs. And I was like, buddy, those aren't girl pants. Like, those are jorts. They're cool. Like, those are great. I was like, our assistant director, he wears them every day. And he's like, yeah, but all my friends, they have girl pants on. And my sister says they have girl pants on. And I'm starting to think maybe I am wearing girl pants. And he just starts bawling. And I said, buddy, I was like, listen, let me see him one more time. And he opens up this towel, and I look closer, and what I can see is his jeans had at one point in time been bedazzled. Do you remember these jeans? And someone had picked off all of the dazzles, but there was still glue residue, like in the shape of little swirls on his pants, and they also had missed a couple. And it hit me, he is wearing girl pants. And I can't say that. And then I look at him and I said, do you have your bathing suit in your bag? He's like, you know what? Just put it on. And there's no more question. He's like, okay. But the story I really want you to hear tonight is not one of the weird kids. It's one of the bad kids. It's this kid. His name is Joey. And Joey was just one of those kids that just made life so hard. It's like we'd all be having fun if you wouldn't be doing this. And we had rented a dunking booth for our camp, and we put it outside and filled up with water. And if you work with kids, you totally get this. No kid wants to throw the ball. Every kid wants to get dunked. Like, why would I want to be the one not getting wet in this situation? So all these kids are lined up to get dunked, and counselors are just sitting there throwing the balls to, you know, dunk kids in, thinking, why don't we own a pool? This is stupid. And so this kid, Joey, gets in, and And the council throws the ball, and you know, there's like maybe 100, 200 kids kind of all standing around here. We have this little carnival set up, and the way the dunking booth was set up, they had a big window in the front, so when you came hitting the water, you could like see their face, kind of like, you know, see the cold water. And so they throw the baseball, and Joey drops down, and right when he hits the water, he turns around and moons everyone through the window. Little girls are screaming. Guy counselors are trying to hold back laughter. And it's just, I'm just like, oh my gosh. You know, these kind of things, you know, you're working with people. It's like, how do you explain this to a parent? You know, it's like, ah. And so we were talking to, we were sitting down and talked to his counselors. And I was like, I don't know, do we kick this kid out? Because it was just, that was just one of his, like, that's the normal thing he did. It was that kind of stuff. Well, a day or two later, his mom came in and said, I just wanted to talk to the directors. And I was like, oh, maybe she knows. And she said, I really want to thank you for the way that you've been treating my kid. I said, okay. And she said, at the end of last summer, my husband and I got a divorce, and he's really been taking it hard. And at the beginning of the summer, I found out that I have terminal cancer, and they've given me less than a year to live. And all of a sudden, it hit me. I thought, this isn't a bad kid. Like, this is a hurting kid. You know, here I feel like I wanted to spank this kid. You know, I wanted to discipline this kid, and this kid needs... Like, this kid doesn't need spanking. This kid needs a hug. You know, he doesn't need withholding of love. This kid needs me to pour it on him. And I sat down with his counselors and told them his story, and we decided, like, why don't, from now on, what if we just treated this kid like he was the best kid at camp? Granted, he's not. But, like, what if from now on we just assume that he is the best kid of camp and treat him that way? The next day, we had a dance contest, and he came up and did the worm, which is not technically a dance move, but someone teaches it to every little white kid and tells them it's a dance move. I see, it's like, what is that? And it's just like these kids flapping on the ground. But we let him win. You know, all the other kids are like, really? But we let him win. And that night, me and his counselors, we took him out to Johnny Rockets, and afterwards we went next door and took him out to a movie. And it was really funny. At one point, the movie got really boring, so we talked him into doing the worm in front of the theater. Like, it was really great. At the end of the night, we dropped. His mom came and picked him up, and the next morning, his mom came and dropped him off at campus. I kind of talked to you, and she sat us down, and she said, "Last night, Joey came home, and he said, Mom, he said, I think today might have been the best day of my life." And with tears in her eyes. And, you know, now, 20 years later, doing camp ministry, I don't see good kids and bad kids. The way we see it and the way we train our staff is that every kid that comes to our camp has a story. It's our job to figure out this kid's story so that we can respond with what this kid needs. Thank you.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining, and they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
Jonathan Owen is a children's minister and the director of Camp Straight Street. You can learn more about him and the camp at campstraightstreet.com.
You remember Leonard Skinner? He got ptomaine poisoning last night after dinner.
You know, that story he tells is such a simple story, really. But I think one of the things that makes it so great is just the way that Jonathan tells it.
Oh, yeah. So it reminds me of the first time he told a story at one of our events. I was nervous about it because you coached him. I didn't coach him.
He didn't even require that much coaching.
Right. And so whenever he's up on the stage telling the story, it was my first time hearing it, but it was within seconds of him getting up there and starting that I realized, oh, yeah. This is going to be really good. And, you know, something that we always say at ArcLight, and I believe, is that anybody can get up there and tell a great story. But for some people, it's just a little bit easier than others. And Jonathan is the perfect example of that. I mean, he is a natural born storyteller.
Yeah, and that's true for our next storyteller as well. He's both a gifted teller and exciting to listen to. And in his story, he's trying to help someone he cares about very much, but there's just a few surprises along the way that completely reframe the way that he's trying to help. And that story's ahead. This is ArcLight Stories, Birmingham's own true stories.
Thanks for joining us for ArcLight Stories. Today's show features stories about change. These are all true, personal stories told by the people who live them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ArcLight.
And I'm story coach Chris Kinsley. Many of us have heroes in our lives, and often our perception of those heroes will change because we discover something about them that makes them seem less heroic to us. But what do we do when we discover something that makes them seem even more heroic? Well, that's exactly what this next story is about. It was recorded at an event we hosted back in August, and the theme for that night was hot summer nights. Here is storyteller Leonard Lee Smith.
When I was in my mid-20s, I went to visit my grandmother one weekend, and after dinner that summer evening, she invited me to go through her hope chest with her, something I had always wanted to do, so I readily said yes. I knew that her hope chest was filled with mementos and souvenirs and personal treasures, but mostly it was filled with stories, and I wanted some of them. The greatest discovery that evening in the hope chest was an ancient pasteboard box filled with all the letters exchanged between my grandmother and my grandfather during the Second World War. They were written on onion skin paper that was so thin, if you held it up to the light, you could see through it. And they were in airmail envelopes that had blue and white and red borders around them. I don't think any of you know what that looks like now, but no one sends letters anymore. And I pulled out one of the letters and opened it up and began to peruse it. And my grandmother took it from my hand and folded it along its creases and put it back in the envelope and said that though the letters were over 40 years old, they were written for her and she didn't want anyone else reading them. And I made it my mission at that point to someday get those letters and read them. Now, she wouldn't let me read the letters, but she did tell me about the first time that she and my grandfather met. She was 11 and he was 14, and it was the summer between school, and his family had just moved into the community, and he turned up at their back screen door on some errand for his mother. She said he had shocking red hair that was moppish and needed cutting. His face was full of freckles. He wore a dirty orange t-shirt, and his left arm hung crooked where it had been badly set by a country doctor. And as he walked down the driveway, she looked at her mother and said, "Mama, I think that's the ugliest boy I've ever met. And I pity the girl that's got to marry him someday." And with a chuckle, she said, 6 years later, I was that girl. Underneath the box of letters was a photo I had never seen before of a sophisticated young couple. The woman had finger-waved hair and wore a stylish broad-brim hat and a tailored dress in a gardenia corsage. The man had on a dark suit with a loud tie, a stylish fedora, and new brogan shoes. And I asked my grandmother who the photo was, and she said, "That's me and your grandfather on the day we got married at the Chilton County Courthouse. I was 17 and he was 20. I looked at the date on the back of the photograph, and it said August 20th, 1940. Now, I had never known the exact date of my grandparents' wedding. And when I got home, I did some calculations of pregnancy, as one of our storytellers talked about. And I realized that my grandparents' hot summer nights had caught up with them. And my grandmother had to get married. Well, it didn't make any difference, because when my grandmother spoke about my grandfather, it was evident that she loved him very much. I didn't know much about my grandfather except that he had served in the military. There were pictures of him in his military uniform around her bedroom. So I knew that the rest of their story was in those letters, and I wanted to get them. And so I would routinely ask if I could have them, and my grandmother always very quickly said no. And then almost 16 years after we had gone through the Hope Chest together, I went to visit her one weekend. And as I was getting ready to leave, she presented me with a present. It was a brown shopping bag, and she handed it to me, and she said, "The letters are in there. It's all in there. You can take as long as you want to read them, but let no one else read them, and when you are finished, return them to me." I hugged and kissed her because I knew this was difficult for her. It was all in there, not just the letters from World War II, but letters they had exchanged when they were in school together. My grandfather told her that she was the smartest, sweetest, and prettiest girl in school. I discovered that they did not like their names. Her name was Ray Seal, and her family called her Seal, and his family called him Junior. But she called him Brown Eyes, and he called her Blue Eyes, and they signed their notes to each other that way. So I delved into the letters to find out the story of my grandparents. Now, about a year after they married, the war broke out, and they had been married about 4 years and had two small sons when, in June of 1944, my grandfather's number came up for the draft. He was working at a fertilizer plant, and that was considered a vital job, so he could have gotten a deferment. But he told my grandmother he had as much to fight for as anyone else, and he would go. So in June of 1944, he shipped off to basic training in Georgia. One of his first letters home read, "My dearest darling Blue Eyes, basic training is still hell. Uncle Sam is endeavoring overtime every day to make us as miserable as possible. If I survive basic training, I won't have to worry about the Japs or the Jerrys because I will be a hard man to kill." I turned my weekend pass back into my CO today and told him I could mope on base as well as I could mope in town. You see, I had a surprise planned, but it didn't work out. There are four men in my platoon from Montgomery, and one of them has a 1942 Buick. We had saved up our money and our gas rations, and we were going to leave Friday night after inspection and drive all night home, visit our wives and girlfriends, and come back on Sunday. But the man who owns the Buick missed bed check on Thursday night, and his pass was revoked. So if I'm feeling a little better next weekend, I'll go to town and have your picture made of me in my uniform. He finished basic and he came home in October of 1944 for 10 days leave and visited his family. And at the end of that 10 days, my grandmother took him to the train station and put him on the train to Fort Meade, Maryland, where he had to report. And sometime in November of 1944, he shipped out to France. Before he sent her a letter from France, she sent him a letter that said, "I'm sorry that the packages we sent you got crushed, but I figured that problem out. I've been saving syrup cans and washing them out, and I can seal your packages up in them, and they will handle whatever Uncle Sam and the post office decides to do to them. They've gotten very strict. And if you want me to send you something, I have to have it requested in a letter. But if you need something, just let me know, and I will move heaven and earth to get it. And if it weighs less than 5 pounds, Uncle Sam will let me send it to you. I love you always, Blue Eyes." His first letter from France read, "My dearest Blue Eyes, when I get home, I will be grateful to have a house and a job and a way to provide for my family. France must have been a beautiful country once, but the Germans have torn it up. But the French people are sweet. They stand on the side of the road and give us apples and what they call schnapps, but we would call whiskey. They kept it buried in the gardens to hide it from the Germans. If the girls have nothing to give, they give us kisses. But don't worry, when I show them my wedding ring, they only kiss me on the cheek. I do wish I could hear from you. Most of the men in my platoon are getting mail now, and I now know I have a big stack of letters coming. I hope that you and my baby boys are okay. I don't think the war can last. We're doing a good job of pushing the Germans back to Berlin, and I think by next spring, all the boys and I will be home, and I am doing my utmost best to stay safe and return to you. So do not worry, for worry ages a woman before her time, and I want to return to the same beautiful bride I left. Loving you always, Brown Eyes. So my mother and my grandmother sent a letter, and there were 88 letters in this, and it was hard to read, folks. So in one of her letters, she said, "I do hope by this time next year, you and all the boys are home, especially you. I do not know if I cannot worry, but if it takes you 50 years to come home, I'll be the same old gal you left waiting." And then in January of 1945, the thing that my grandmother did not want to receive arrived with the postman. She had to sign for it. It was a telegram rimmed in black. "The War Department regrets to inform you that Private Leonard Lee Smith is listed missing in action as of the first day of January 1945. We will contact you as soon as possible if we have any further information." And my grandmother waited. And she waited, and she prayed, and she hoped that he was okay. And then June came, and the war was over in Europe, but there was still no word. And then August came, and the Japanese surrendered, and the war was over altogether, but still she didn't hear anything. And then finally, in December of 1945, there it was on the bottom of the box, a letter. "With deepest sympathy, the War Department regrets to inform you that Private Leonard Lee Smith is listed as killed in action on the day formerly listed as missing." And that was it. With a letter, he was gone. And then something occurred to me. If he had been missing in action for that long, and then he had died, I understood that she should have his letters to her, but why did she have his letters to him? How did those letters get back to her? And then I noticed the box that she had given me. And faded out on the front was a label from the APO. Now, for those of you who don't know, the APO is the Army Post Office. And you are given a number. And that is you, and that is how they find you in the field. And this label said, "To Mrs. Leonard Lee Smith, Jr., APO, care of the Postmaster General, New York, New York. Return to sender. Whereabouts unknown. Contents undeliverable." None of her letters had ever reached him. They had messed up his APO numbers, and after the telegram, they sent them back to her in a bundle. I was heartbroken for my grandmother. And I understood at that moment why she never talked about him and why she had never told me the rest of the story. I never gave the letters back, and she never asked for them. But about 5 years after she gave me the letters, I went to visit her one weekend. She was in her late 70s by now, and arthritis and osteoporosis were affecting her, as was circulation problems that had come from a lifetime of smoking. Recently, the family had started a united campaign to get her to leave her house. And I was elected to spearhead that campaign. Now, the neighborhood she lived in had been in steady decline for 20 years, but when I went to visit her, I realized it had reached rock bottom. All the houses on her street were boarded up, and everyone had moved away except for one. But the only house that was occupied was doing a brisk drug trade because cars were coming and going at all hours of the night. The only thing that was keeping her safe is that my father stopped by at least once a day in his police squad car to check on her and made his presence known. And her house was like a little jewel on the block, because in this desolate block of ruin, there in the middle was a little blue house with fresh paint, a new roof, and an immaculately kept garden. And she was well prepared for me when I arrived. As soon as I started my campaign to get her out of the house, I realized that when it comes to negotiations and diplomacy, Henry Kissinger and Jimmy Carter are amateurs compared to my grandmother. She started with all of her reasons. Her father had built this house for her during the war. It was the only house she had ever owned. Her father had been a cabinet maker. She would never find another house made as well. What was she to do with all of her things? She was on a fixed income and could not afford a retirement home or assisted living. Besides, she was a war widow and had never remarried, and so she had base privileges, and she did all her shopping at the commissary and the PX on Maxwell Air Force Base, and it was just 5 blocks away. If she moved across town, nobody would drive her all the way to the Air Force Base. Her reasons went on and on and on, and I realized that this was going to be difficult. On my last night with her, we had a habit of we would lie in bed at night after we turned out the lights, and we would talk across the darkened hall through the open bedroom doors. And again, I started for one last time to try and convince her that maybe she needed to leave this house. But with what she told me, I resigned from the family campaign, because this is what she said. "I do not think I can leave this house. 56 years ago, I stood on a train platform. I hugged and kissed my husband and told him that I loved him, and I gave him to the U.S. Army. And they never gave him back. In 1948, I signed the papers to have his body repatriated, and they gave me someone to bury, but I could never believe who they gave me was mine. You see, they said they found his dog tags near him, not on him, and they could not return to me his wristwatch or his pocket knife or his wedding ring. I remember going to the movies in 1945 and watching the newsreels of the POWs in Europe and looking for his face in the crowd. Whoever they gave me, he was somebody. Somebody loved him and somebody missed him. And the least I could do for him was to bury him with all the honors I could afford and make sure that his grave stayed clean and decorated on all the appropriate days. And I have done that for over 50 years. I do not know how much sense it has made, how strongly I believed it, or if I ever stopped believing it. But I always hoped he was somewhere with amnesia, and if he ever came back to himself, he'd come back to this house. Thank you. Good night.
Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day.
Leonard Lee Smith is a hairdresser and professional storyteller, and he can be found regaling listeners with his stories at various venues all around Birmingham.
Till the blue skies chase those dark clouds far away.
So, you know, we don't just record these live in front of an audience, but we also have them tell these stories without the use of notes, and we're always encouraging them to not even memorize their stories. There's obviously these letters that Lee shares that he has memorized, but what I love about it is it's so obvious that not only has he memorized them, but like he's deeply internalized them. Like these are things that are coming from his heart. And I think that really comes through, you know, to us as the listeners, and helps us connect with him as a storyteller, even on a completely different level. And that makes it something that's really special.
Yeah. Yeah. So speaking of those events, we would like for you to come and be a part of our audience at one of our events. Our next ArcLight event is just over a week away on Saturday, February 28th at 7:30 p.m. at the Avon Theater. The theme is Love is a Battlefield. Stories about love and heartbreak. Then, in March, we're partnering with the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute to hear stories from the struggle for civil rights. That event will be Saturday, March 21st at 7:30 p.m. at the Red Mountain Theater Cabaret. We've already got our 6 storytellers lined up for that, and I can honestly say that it is the most fascinating set of stories that I've ever worked on for one of our events. For more information and to stay up to date with all of our events, you can check out our website, arclightstories.com.
Thanks for listening to Arclight Stories. This program is produced in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering was done by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon, Brooks and Senior Etheridge, Clayton and Megan Graves, Nate Dreger, Birmingham Community Church, Red Mountain Church, the Avon Theater, Church Street Coffee, Urban Standard, Sunburst Financial, and Studio Flower. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, on SoundCloud, and on our website, arclightstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, you can stay up to date on our events, and you can even submit your own story to tell. After all, we're always asking, what's your story?